Orange Taxi, a new taxi company providing services to the U of I campus and the Champaign-Urbana area 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at 367-8888.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Thanks very much for tuning in. In this first hour of the show today, we'll be talking about Japan. In the post-war era, Japan has become one of the world's leading economies. Certainly, things aren't quite as good today as they were in the 80s, but nonetheless, Japan is still a very powerful economic force in the world. Only recently, however, that is within the last decade or so, perhaps, has the country begun to move onto the world stage as a political player. And as that has happened, Japan has faced some criticism. It has faced criticism and fear from some of its neighbors in Asia that remember its conduct in World War II. It's even faced criticism, some internal criticism, from Japanese who are concerned about rising militarism in Japan, its involvement outside the country with military force, even if those people are only involved in peacekeeping. And from time to time, on a fairly regular basis, in the Western media, you see stories about nationalism in Japan, how it is on the increase, and obviously, at least in the minds of the people who write the stories, that it is a concern, something to be noted and something to be worried about. This morning, in this first part of the show, one of the basic questions we ask is nationalism on the rise in Japan? And is that something that Japanese are worried about? And should we be worried about it? And our guest for the program is Kevin Doak. He is a professor of East Asian Languages and Cultures at Georgetown University. In fact, he's the chair of the department. He's been there since 2002. He's interested in a number of things, including Japanese intellectual history and also issues of ethnicity, race, and nationalism. He's been there since 2002, and before that, between 1994 and 2002, he was on the faculty here at University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. He's talking with us by telephone, and as we talk, questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also do have that toll-free line. That one is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. At any point here, people who are listening have questions, so you're welcome to call. We just ask callers to be brief. We ask that so that we can keep the program moving and get in as many people as possible. But, of course, anyone who is listening is welcome to call. Professor Doak, hello.
Good morning, David.
Thanks for talking with us today.
It's good to be back talking with you again.
Well, let me do this, and let me just note this article that caught our attention, and this is why it is we started thinking about it. This was an article, and I would imagine you probably saw it. It was in the New York Times, December 16th, and it was about the fact that one teacher in particular, and I guess a number of teachers in Japan, had raised objections to a new regulation that was required by the Board of Education in Tokyo. It required teachers to sing the national anthem while standing and facing the national flag. And this one teacher in particular said he and some other teachers said, no, I won't do that because for them, and I'm quoting here from the story, they felt that the flag and the anthem were symbols of Japanese imperialism. And here the author of the story, the journalist who wrote the story, who I don't know if he is Japanese, he has a Japanese name, Noemitsu Onishi, he writes this, many Japanese felt the same way for decades after World War II, but perhaps because they are now more comfortable with their history, or perhaps because Japanese society has moved right, the authorities here have made respect for the flag and anthem mandatory for teachers and students. To supporters, the move is a step to make Japan into a so-called normal country that can be patriotic and proud of itself. To critics, it is dangerous indoctrination that has no place in a democracy. So here, I guess I have some very basic questions, and I'm interested in having you give us some background and perhaps broadening our understanding. And maybe the place to start is by asking about Japanese nationalism, whether in fact nationalism in Japan is on the rise and is, and I know that you're not specifically a political scientist, but I'm sure that you spent enough time watching Japan so that you could have something to say about a question like, is Japanese politics moving to the right?
Those are very interesting questions. And one of the senses of frustration I often get reading articles in the media, like the one that you mentioned in the New York Times, is that Americans are often poorly informed about what nationalism means in general, and particularly what it means in particular societies. And therefore, when we hear an article about nationalism in Japan, I think oftentimes we think of Pearl Harbor, or we think of war, or we think of threats and dangers. And I think there's a lot more than that going on in Japan. In part, what's happening, and has been happening for probably the last 20, 25 years, has been an attempt to come to terms with Japan's rather strange post-war history. The first thing I think that your listeners need to understand, if they don't already, is that modern Japan, or I should say post-war Japan, after the defeat in the war, was a militarily occupied country for 7 years by the United States. And that the government and that the constitution which they live under today, the governmental system, I should say, was largely formed, and the constitution almost entirely formed by the military occupying power, again, the United States. Now, that creates problems for citizenship, for civic engagement, for what we would call a kind of democratic nationalism, that is to say, all the people seeing themselves as a community for which they themselves are responsible. And what's happened, I think, instead, has been a tremendous political disenchantment and disengagement. And many Japanese people have just gone on about their lives. As one person said, economics was the way to survive as a Japanese rather than politics. And since the 1980s, it became clear that, as you said in your introduction, Japan's economic wealth brought with it, or I think you implied at least, certain political responsibilities for the world, as we just saw with this terrible tsunami tragedy. It's not enough simply today to be an economic power. I think that you have to also bring with it the ability to influence affairs in the political world for democracy, for democratic hopes. I think that's less the case so much with the tsunami incident as it is in the war on terrorism or the offense in Iraq. So the problem we have in Japan is that the Japanese people are very wary of any direction by their government, since they have a long tradition of either an occupied force or a government that's been put in place largely by the occupied force, or you could go back to the origins of modern Japanese democracy from 1868 to 1945, when the Japanese people weren't really citizens. They were constitutionally subjects of the emperor. And the right to vote wasn't extended to men until 1928, and to women until after the war by the Americans. So I think what we're dealing with is a long tradition of disengagement, a weak sense of responsible citizenship. And then on top of that, you have these larger global events that are dragging Japan into the world, requiring it to play a responsible role in the United Nations and other coalitions. And the Japanese people are rather confused by all this as to whether they should engage with politics, trust the government, become involved in civic affairs and civic values, such as a national anthem and the national flag. And I think the interesting thing about the story that you were citing about this resistance to Japanese people showing respect to the national flag or singing the national anthem is to compare with America. We just had in our news stories some complaints about religious words being used in, say, the Pledge of Allegiance. But nobody in America, to my knowledge, no major political group, has suggested that we not say the Pledge of Allegiance. You know, if we could only get rid of the references to religion, I think most people would be fine with it. In Japan's case, it's even further extreme than that. The people who are resisting the national anthem and the national flag don't want any of it. It's not simply a matter of religion, although that's an interesting sidelight we might want to discuss. They just don't want any sense of membership in a political sense of nationhood.
Well, let me ask you another question, and that is, it gets to the matter that the way that we react to this kind of story, the fact that it's in the New York Times at all, it's in the Western media at all,
right,
probably says at least as much about us and the Western perspective, our way of looking at Japan, as it does about the Japanese and the way that they're looking at themselves. So I guess the question is, why is it that it seems to worry us? Why is it that what we see, these signs that we interpret as rising nationalism, and we have a certain way of thinking about that, which may not be correct, but why is it that this is something that it seems to worry us?
That's a very good question, and it's not an easy one to answer. I think the offhand answer that we see so often is simply that America's had a kind of client-state relationship with Japan for most of the post-war period, and we don't want to let go of control. And the notion that the Japanese might actually develop more independent foreign policies, that they may begin to act as an independent but yet democratic state, means a loosening of our ability to control affairs there, which we've had for most of the post-war period. That's one reaction. Mm-hmm. I think another one is that things are changing throughout the region, things with Taiwan, Korea, and China. And there's some concern that the entire region is being engulfed by nationalism. And would rising nationalism in Japan and rising nationalism in China and Korea and Taiwan certainly lead to a greater involvement by the United States militarily as well as politically? And is that something that we really want to get involved with right now? Those are two potential reasons that Americans read this. I think in the back of the minds of many Americans is still, of course, when they think of Japan, they think of Pearl Harbor, they think of World War II, especially the older generation. And for them, I think many of these older generations just can't really accept that Japan over the course of the last 50-some years has changed, has become democratic. So people bring to these stories, I think, all kinds of their own personal concerns and personal assumptions.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Kevin Doak. He is chair of the Department of East Asian Languages and Cultures at Georgetown University, and he is very interested in Japanese intellectual history and issues of ethnicity and race and nationalism, among other things. And we're talking this morning about contemporary Japan. We've started out talking here about the issue of nationalism, and perhaps we'll get onto some other things. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I think that it's true that over the last, I'm not sure how long this has been now, several decades, I guess, there have been some Japanese in various spheres, people who are, I'm sure, journalists, people in politics, people who are in the academy, people who are in the business world, who have said, I'm not sure how publicly, but who have said that they felt that for a long time a problem with Japan was that it was too inward-looking. Mm-hmm. And that it was important for Japan to become a player on the world stage, and not just in an economic sense. And we have, in fact, seen that recently as Japan has become very important as a provider of international financial aid, and also that Japanese troops actually have been now involved for the first time outside of the country.
Outside the region.
Following the invasion of Iraq. Now, and I know also that these things have been controversial among Japanese. But I guess I'm wondering, to the extent that, you know, you can say, how Japanese people think about this matter of being, of looking outward, about being involved internationally, and about opening out, becoming more involved in the world in those sorts of ways.
Right. It's a very interesting question because people report on Japan's lack of international consciousness or its insularity in various different ways. And I see there's a paradox there. On the one hand, I was in Japan a couple of years ago, and I had two young children who were in the public school systems. And I found the public school texts were extremely international, much more promoting of international values than American textbooks are. But by internationalism, they largely meant peaceful, economic kinds of issues. Internationalism that doesn't have a cost, that doesn't create any waves or that nobody would object to. When people critique Japan for being insular or for not being international, generally what they mean is, why is Japan not playing a stronger role for democracy in the world? Here we have, certainly East Asia's strongest democracy, a great ally of the United States, and yet it's hamstrung in many ways by its tradition and by many of the people's attitudes. For example, the war in Iraq, recently a survey showed that 88% of the Japanese people, reading different numbers, 84% of the people surveyed were against the Iraq war. But the subtext is, of those, 73% were against all wars as a matter of principle. So we have a very strong pacifism in Japan that, I think, to be honest, comes from the fact that Japanese were the only people who've ever been bombed by nuclear, atomic, and plutonium weapons, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and that they went through a disastrous 15-year-long war, accumulating in 1945, and that left the Japanese people with a really strong animosity or a sense of war being, in all costs at all times, wrong. And there's the use of military force is something that is extremely controversial, or I should say probably extremely opposed by many Japanese people under all circumstances. Then you have Japan as a major player in the world today for democratic states trying to establish a security, permanent security seat in the United Nations. And I think this whole question then becomes part of a larger global reorientation. Japan cannot get a permanent seat in the United Nations unless it's willing to bring its military into coalition in use outside the region sometimes, as they finally have done. Koizumi has pushed small token amounts of the Japanese military into the Iraq coalition against the great opposition of his people because he believes that Japan has to start playing a larger role in promoting coalition and international organizations. So it's a real dilemma.
We have a caller, and I want to bring them into the conversation. Our telephone number, by the way, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's for people who are here in the area around Champaign-Urbana. If it would be a long-distance call, however, use our toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. Here's a caller, someone on a cell phone, line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Usually, when nationalism arises, there is often a rise in anti-Semitism. And I've heard that in Japan there is a rise in anti-Semitism. And I'm wondering if that's really true, and if it is, to what extent it is true. And I'm going to hang up. Thank you.
All right.
It's an interesting question to get from the Champaign-Urbana area, because my former colleague there, David Goodman, is an expert on the topic.
Mm-hmm.
And David's written at least one book and many other things on that, and I share his conclusions, which is that anti-Semitism in Japan might best be called philo-Semitism. It's a kind of bizarre obsession many people have with Jewish people, oftentimes seen in an intentionally positive light. In fact, we just had touring in Washington, D.C., and I think around the country, a theatrical production on Senpo Sugihara, who was the man in World War II. They call him the Japanese Schindler, who saved many Japanese people through his diplomatic connections. So I don't think there is a kind of attack on Jewish people that you find other places. But your caller has an interesting point that has to be, I think, looked at more deeply, and that is nationalism generally gives rise to ethnic hatreds. So that in Europe, for example, German nationalism gave rise to an ethnic hatred of Jews. In Japan, one of my concerns in my research has been looking at how one form of nationalism in Japan, which oftentimes is resistant to its own state, I mean, it opposes Japanese post-war government for being too American, but that kind of ethnic nationalism, in fact, leads to discrimination against Koreans and Chinese and other ethnic minorities within Japan. But in terms of oppressing Jews, first of all, there just aren't that many Jews in Japan. And secondly, there's a strong tradition, particularly among conservatives, of identifying with the Jews. So I think the real question is how nationalism gives rise to a hatred of ethnic others.
I have another caller here. Again, someone who's calling on a cell phone. This is on our toll-free line. We'll go there. Line four. Hello.
Hello. Good morning. Can you hear me all right?
Yes.
I'm very interested by this topic because one of my concerns after the fact of the last election was that my impression that, unfortunately, the Democrats did not make a case for internationalism as opposed to nationalism. And I feel that the Republican Party under Mr. Bush have moved very strongly in a nationalist direction. And the comment about the rise of ethnic hatreds might fit into a general anger towards Islamic peoples. And this is my biggest concern in my about American foreign policy right now, is a rise in what I consider a nationalist viewpoint about all things that take place in the globe. I'm curious what your guests would have to say about this.
That's a interesting question. I'm trying to see how I can weave it into Japan and East Asia. I think that there has been a rising antagonism towards President Bush, even before the re-election, and in Japan, and that oftentimes reaches over into a kind of broad anti-Americanism by association. People don't often make the distinctions, but sometimes they do between this administration and the American government, per se. Internationalism and nationalism, I think, are oftentimes more intertwined than we think, that it's quite possible to use nationalist resources for international goals. Mm-hmm. And I think that internationalism, properly understood, is really when nations, acting as nations, come together in a way that serves their interest. The real question where nationalism and internationalism is a conflict with Japan today has to do with the regional questions of the Senkaku Islands, which China invaded last year, which are in Japanese territory, the question of the Northern Territories, which is in dispute with the Russia now, former Soviet Union, And, of course, the whole question over North Korea, where a number of Japanese had been kidnapped by North Koreans and raised in Korea and sometimes killed or died over the years since the 1970s. And these kinds of issues are so shot through with nationalist interests, particularly the Senkaku Islands, and yet they have to be reconciled or resolved somehow through international cooperation. And I think the Japanese, although many Japanese people are express anti-Bush sentiments, particularly because of the war, as I said, they're very pacifistic, I've also read that many Japanese people are grateful that Bush is approaching the question of North Korea the way he is, through diplomacy and through coalition building, rather than through unilateral approaches that other people had suggested, or through, of course, military might.
Well, if Japan is able to step forward into a full role at the United Nations, their presence there as a pacifist nation might be very helpful and useful in that body.
Right. I think the pacifist attitudes would be helpful if they can be reconciled with the use of military power. I don't think that Japan's going to get a permanent security seat unless it, like France and England and other permanent security seats, are willing to use their military force for the interests of the United Nations. And right now, there's so much opposition to the use of Japanese military, even for peacekeeping operations, because a young PKO Japanese person, was killed several years back. And the Japanese said, well, let's just pull out. Let's not even involve ourselves in peacekeeping United Nations operations. And Koizumi just threw rather a fiat, sent a good number of the troops to Iraq, making sure that they were cordoned off by other troops so that they wouldn't be anywhere near harm's way. And even that's very controversial in Japan. So I don't think Japan's pacifist values are going to get the strength of United Nations policy making unless, first of all, they're able to somehow compromise with those in order to use their military forces, at least for United Nations missions. So I think they're really in a kind of logjam there.
Well, thank you very much for responding to my question.
All right, well, thanks for the call.
You're welcome.
This is actually something that is restructuring of the UN that we're going to be talking about later in the week. On Friday, we'll be doing a program on this. And as you've touched on here, one of the sorts of suggestions that has been made is the possibility of expanding the Security Council, adding some more seats, and having Japan be a member. Is that something that there would be strong support for among Japanese people?
That's a very good question, because Japanese people, like many democracies, are split over the issues. The current prime minister, of course, Koizumi, has in fact, just recently, last September, made a speech before the United Nations General Assembly in New York, in which he made the case for Japan being granted a permanent seat in the Security Council. And the other thing that your listeners need to know is that he also said there's a need to get rid of the clause in the UN Charter that talks about enemy states, which, of course, Japan was numbered as one of them. How many people would support this? Difficult to say, but the most recent numbers I have on Koizumi's popularity by a newspaper, which is not very fond of him, suggest that it's somewhere around 44%. That could seem low and is often reported as low, but actually, historically, with American presidents, it's not bad. The problem is that Japan has a cabinet system, and elections could be held at any minute, more or less. So they do keep an eye on those publicity or the public opinion approval rates. The other thing that needs to be brought into this, however, is that while Koizumi's ratings are not as high as he would like, there's nobody else on the scene. There's nobody else that his opposition would rally around. So he's likely to stay in office, and he's pushing very hard. And I think there's a good many Japanese people who would like to have a permanent seat in the UN Security Council, although of those people, not all of them would like to do it under the conditions of having to employ military power.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, again, is Kevin Doak. He chairs the Department of East Asian Languages and Cultures at Georgetown University, was for a number of years before going to Georgetown on the faculty here at the U of I, Urbana-Champaign. And we're talking about contemporary Japan and looking particularly at the subject of nationalism, something that he is interested in and he has written on. Questions, comments are certainly welcome. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. We're at our midpoint here, and because it is the first Tuesday of the month, we have to pause here for a moment to do something that will continue our conversation. We'll pause for a moment for this test of the emergency activation system.
This message was instituted by the Illinois Emergency Management Agency. This station is participating in a required monthly test of the Illinois Emergency Alert System. This system was developed to provide information to the public during emergencies. This was a test.
And you are listening to Focus 580. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning here on AM 580. And again, in this part of Focus, we're talking with Kevin Doak from Georgetown University. I wanted to talk a little bit more about Mr. Koizumi. I was interested. I was reading a column in the Asahi newspaper, a column on Japanese politics by a journalist who apparently has been writing this column for a long time, kind of taking stock of what has happened since Mr. Koizumi became the prime minister in the spring of 2001. And this column, as his observation is, since we entered the Koizumi era, Japanese politics have swayed violently between booms and bashings. And he talks about the fact that early on, people apparently were very excited about Mr. Koizumi because he is different. He is not in the mold of more traditional Japanese politicians. And like American politicians or politicians elsewhere, he campaigned with the promise of shaking up politics as usual. He said he was going to take on the prevailing party, the LDP. He promised to take the party apart. He also promised to revive Japan's economy. And now I think he has now come in for some criticism because he really hasn't managed to do either of those things, at least not to the extent that he promised. But one thing I did specifically I wanted to ask you about that ties into this topic that we're talking about, one of the things that has drawn some criticism is Mr. Koizumi's annual visit to the Yasukuni Shrine, which is a temple, a Shinto temple. It's in Tokyo, and it's a memorial to Japanese war dead, not just in World War II, but apparently a number of wars going back to the 1860s. And what makes it controversial is that it also honors some of the dead in World War II, among them people who are war criminals. So that just for some people, just the fact that he would go there would be a controversial, troublesome sort of gesture to make. And this is, again, that's one of those things that is often referred to in stories about him, about Japanese politics, about Japanese nationalism. Just what sort of significance does that have? What does that mean?
Well, it's a hot button. It's a really complicated question. And he was criticized, I think, most recently by a Chinese high-level official for doing this, who brought it out in a meeting that they had. It was an APEC meeting. And the critiques over Yasukuni are very interesting. There's legitimate grounds for critiquing him, and then there are times when I would say people probably shouldn't be criticizing him. And I think it's quite ironic that the Chinese government officially protested when they're the first to usually talk about internal affairs, that you know, China's internal affairs are sacred and nobody should be involved in them. Mm-hmm. And the Japanese government sense, although they didn't quite articulate this directly, was that this is an internal matter, that every country ought to have an Arlington National Cemetery. And at that level, I can understand the point that Japan doesn't have something like we do, Arlington National Cemetery, to honor all of the people who've sacrificed their lives for their country. And Yasukuni Shrine comes the closest to it. Now, the problem with Yasukuni Shrine, of course, as you noted, is that it's a Shinto shrine. And the post-war constitution in Japan, like the American Constitution, has a separation of church and state clause. So there's been a lot of controversy about whether a sitting prime minister could go in an official capacity to the Shinto shrine. And some prime ministers have argued that they can go as long as they make it clear they're going in a private capacity. And I think Koizumi's been rather impatient with those kinds of niceties. What Koizumi is trying to do is find a way that the Japanese people can respect everyone who gave their lives for their country, even if the cause wasn't good. And I think one of the places where he can legitimately be criticized is that to the degree to which Yasukuni still remains a Shinto shrine, this involves him in a particular religious, almost an establishment of religion situation. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that's rather important, significant about this, is that a good many of the people who are honored, whose spirits are interred in Yasukuni, are Christian, and some of them are Koreans and Taiwanese who fought for the Japanese in the imperial period. And there's been also a controversy about should people who aren't Shinto, people who have different religions, be forced because of their involvement in Japan's wars to be interred and honored in the Shinto shrine. So obviously there's going to have to be a solution, and people talk about whether or not there could be established a kind of secular public or national cemetery like America has in Arlington, or whether some other solution could be arrived at. And I think one of the problems with the proposal of establishing a public civic national cemetery like Arlington is that there's also tremendous animosity in Japan towards anything the state does. I mean, you mentioned before the break, the Japanese government, the legislature, passed a law, democratically elected legislature, passed a law stipulating for the first time in the post-war history that the flag and the anthem, Kimigayo, would be the national flag and the national anthem. Prior to that time, they didn't have a national flag or national anthem, and there was a tremendous human outcry over this. So you could imagine if this legislature established a law setting out some national cemetery, that there would likely be a similar hue and cry over how nationalistic this is. The irony is that for many Japanese people, a Shinto shrine is more acceptable than a national state cemetery, which would evoke images and memories of statism in their lives during World War II, because there still are very many devout Shinto practitioners in Japan who nonetheless don't care much for the state. So it's a very complicated problem, and particularly when foreign statesmen, such as this Chinese statesman, get involved in this, because I think they often don't see these nuances and complications and simply see this as some kind of Japanese conspiracy to, I don't know, invade China or something like that.
Yeah. Let's talk with someone else. We have a caller here in Urbana, line one.
Yeah, I was wondering about the significance of the end of the bubble economy over the past decade. My perception is that it's changed the way that many Japanese feel about themselves, their families, and their community, and that it's made them a little more thoughtful, introspective, and community-minded. And so first, I'm wondering if you think this is true, and secondly, how that might then translate or have implications for the issues you're talking about, how they feel about the country and its place in the world.
Hmm. That's a very, very good question. I was in Japan several times during the collapse of the bubble economy, this when the inflated land prices came back down and a lot of stocks and bank debt that had built up over those inflated land prices came crashing. Japan faces and still faces a major, major debt problem, and it's caused layoffs for pretty much essentially the first time in post-war history. And while one would like to think that it's turned people towards community and towards more important values, it's also had the impact of creating all kinds of social discord, murders of school children by school children, fathers who commit suicide, mothers who kill their children. There's been a tremendous sense of political and social and cultural instability and uncertainty and anxiety. It definitely impacts the larger global world, because one of the things Koizumi was supposed to do was to redress this problem of the bad debt resulting from the bubble economy. And he found there are tremendously strong, entrenched interests that are resisting him. And he continues to try to do that with his finance minister, Takenaka. But he's up against a lot of opposition. So at the macro level, they're continuing to address the problem. At the social level, when I was in Japan, I noticed a lot of stores that had gone out of business. For the first time I'd ever been in Japan, I started seeing lots of signs on permanent holiday, essentially. And it has had a tremendous personal cost on the Japanese people, and this is one of the reasons there was so much hope that Koizumi could turn it around. Having said all the bad news, it's important to note that the Japanese economy is, in fact, growing at this point, growing very, very, very small. I think second quarter of last year, they had about a 0.3% economic growth rate. But nonetheless, they've turned around the negative growth rates into positive growth rates. And I think in time, and with some adjustments and restructuring that Koizumi administration is trying to take to implement, they might be able to turn this thing around. The social costs are big, and they're part of a broader cultural change that's taking place in Japan. And I just don't know yet where it's all going to lead, but I would underscore that when I was there a couple of years ago, I could see the pain in people's lives.
Does that get at your question, caller?
Yeah, it's a complicated one. Thank you.
All right. Well,
thank
let's
you.
Go to another caller in Indiana. This is someone on line number four, our toll-free line. Hello.
Hello. I'd like to take advantage of this situation, having somebody I know must talk to politicians and gives advice. If you could put on two hats, Republican, Bush Republican, present period, versus, say, Democratic advisor to the president, and what you've been talking about the last half hour or so, Could you sort of give, you know, have two mouths and say what a Republican advisor with Bush would be telling him, you know, in the general sweep of things, what to do, and what, you know, a speculative Kerry president advisor would be telling him what to do, if at all possible. Thanks.
Oh, interesting question. I've often been accused of having two minds, but I don't know if I can have two mouths. I'll try. I think that if I were a Republican advisor to President Bush, I would probably encourage him to continue building a coalition of regional powers to address the problem of North Korea's probable possession of nuclear weapons, and at the same time try to resolve the kidnapping incident of Japanese citizens. And I would probably encourage him to continue reaching out to Koizumi and to continue to try to bring Koizumi into the international coalition and ultimately to a permanent seat in the United Nations. If I were a Democratic advisor to a Democratic president right now, I would probably, as I understand, follow the Kerry administration's arguments before the election that the problem in Korea needs to be addressed unilaterally, that more attention needs to be given to China's interests in the region, and that we should probably not put so much emphasis on such personal and local questions about kidnapping as we should about the question of Taiwan and the larger regional kinds of questions. But I'm not sure I can play either Republican or Democrat advisor so well.
Well, given, I realize, by the way, that we're asking you questions about politics and economics that really aren't your area of specialization.
Yeah.
But having said that, given the fact that Japan's neighbors in East Asia continue to be uncomfortable with Japan's power and influence, and that for them the memory of what Japan did in the Second World War is still fresh. And given the fact that also that there are economic, both political and economic rivalries going, particularly between Japan and China, for who will be the leading power in the region, you know, given that background, how difficult will it be for Japan to become a major, if not the lead, political player in the region?
Mm-hmm.
And how do these countries, do you think, sort out these various kinds of rivalries and sort out their past to come together in a kind of effective way for their region?
Yeah. I think the regional focus is the right one to take, and it highlights a number of complexities, a lot of perplexing problems that are facing the entire world. One thing about this constant bringing up of Japanese nationalism or World War II, mm-hmm. and I'm partly guilty of that because that's what I write on, and I want to make it clear, especially to the listeners, that if someone's talking about Japanese nationalism like myself, it doesn't necessarily mean that that's the problem, and we shouldn't forget the other nationalisms in the region as well. But in many of these cases, Korea, China to a certain degree, Taiwan, nationalism is a force that seeks the maturity and development of a nation which has not completely reached full development. Korea, the question, of course, is unification, and nationalism is a big part of that. Taiwan, there's a sense that people who've grown up there now 50 years in this country have their own culture, their own identity. And Taiwan is saying no, or China is saying no, you don't, you're part of us. Clearly, the question of nationalism in China needs equal attention. And therefore, oftentimes, these rival nationalist claims from Korea and China in particular, and to some degree Taiwan, raise the past, raise the question of World War II. And Japanese are often perplexed by that because the Japanese government, the constitution, and the people are entirely different from what was there 50, 60 years ago. And the Japanese, as I just stated, are extremely pacifistic. So one wonders why these questions of World War II and history textbooks and Yasukuni and even Japanese nationalism are constantly brought up. Well, one of the reasons they're brought up, I think, is to keep Japan off-center, so to speak. And the result of all that has been, throughout the post-war period, the need for our United States involvement in East Asia. In a sense, Japan can play the role of economic donor. America is supposed to play the role of the muscle for democracy in the region. as that region changes and as America's commitments grow in other parts of the world, there's a reassessment going on as to whether or not the United States can feasibly be involved in East Asia. And if we have to withdraw from East Asia, some people like Chalmers Johnson are arguing, who's going to fill the void? Do we want China to fill the void? Would that promote democracy? Do we want Japan to fill the void? Would that promote stability? What would happen to Taiwan, and what's likely to happen to Korea? So as of now, I don't believe that there's any realistic prospectus for security and democracy in the region without United States involvement. And I say that fully aware that we're already probably overcommitted.
Well, that gets at the question that was in my mind. If you look back to the 1980s, the time when the Japanese economy was really booming, and here in the United States, we were concerned about Japan as an economic competitor. The media in this country was full of stories about Japanese culture, about Japanese business culture, about Japanese popular culture, right, perhaps some about Japanese politics, but more those other two things. And it seemed that at some points we were just obsessed with Japan. And then when the bubble burst, the Japanese economy cooled, then it was almost as if Japan just dropped off the map. As far as a lot of Americans were concerned. So I guess the question that I'm heading toward is something like, what does Japan mean to the United States today?
That's a great, great question. One of the things that I've been trying to do over that entire period, I remember I was in Japan in the 80s and everybody was agog about Japan, has been trying to normalize Japan. And by that I mean, my interest in Japanese nationalism is not to say this is the greatest threat to the region or we all have to watch out, they're coming to get us, there's going to be another attack, none of that. I mean, that would be crazy. It's outlandish. My interest in nationalism in Japan comes from the question that all nation states, particularly democratic nation states, need to tame nationalism if they're going to be effective democratic citizenry in their countries. And to a great degree, Japan has neither tamed nationalism nor has it encouraged a healthy sense of citizenship. So what I would like Americans to finally recognize is that Japan shouldn't be something that we're fascinated with when we're thinking of cherry blossoms and geisha. And Japan shouldn't be a great fear when we think about economics and trade or military, but rather Japan is moving very rapidly towards a normal country and a normal society, a very important one, and that we should pay a lot of attention to Japan because it's economically important, because it's a great democracy in a world where there aren't that many democracies, and because in the post-war period, the Japanese have become extremely familiar with and appreciative of America. I don't know if I gave these numbers earlier, but let me give them again if I did. The recent surveys show that 88% of the Japanese people believe the world would be less safe without American influence. Now, that contrasts with the next leading nation who believes that United States influence is good for the world, which is England. And that's only 60% of the British feel that way. So when you look at this, the United States has a great friend in Asia, in spite of contemporary political differences with the Bush administration and the war in Iraq. And the Japanese people are extremely familiar with American culture. And my sense is that Japan is moving toward a normal nation and that we should be very interested in that.
Let's talk with another caller. This is someone also listening in Urbana this morning, line one. Hello.
Yeah. I read into what you said that you read Japanese then? Is that?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Well, I just wanted to know if you had read much in or seen anything in the Japanese literature of how they. This is coming from the fact I believe that they're aging very quickly, and
right.
I believe they think they're going to have to import workers. And, I have to accept immigrants to a much greater degree than they ever did before. And yet, and put that with China's ascendancy, and I'm just curious if they might be thinking that they're going to have to move closer to China and perhaps the people that come in to help them, sustain this bubble in the demographics, this hump in the demographics would be Chinese. I just want to know what you've might have read about what they're thinking of in terms of how to deal with China and its ascendancy. Thank you.
All right. That's a very good question. Let me quickly deal with the birth problem by mentioning that in Koizumi's cabinet, there's a minister named Chieko No, a woman, and one of her jobs is to be Minister of State for Youth Affairs and Measures for Declining Birth Rate. There's been recently an important high-level government conference on what to do about the declining birth rate in Japan. At that point, it's very important to note that Japan's declining birth rate is largely a similar phenomenon to what you find in industrialized European countries. Right? But placed in East Asia, the caller did, it raises the question of its relationship to China. I'm not entirely convinced, however, that a large number of young people in a society is necessarily an asset. It only looks like an asset when you don't have enough and you're thinking about social welfare spending, who's going to pay the taxes and who's going to take care of the old people. But in many other parts of the world, including the Mideast, a large number of young people creates questions of unemployment and political, economic, and other kinds of instabilities. So I don't know that the birth rates alone or the population and demographics suggest a rising China and a declining Japan. Part of China's economic rise, a great deal of it, has been, of course, the result of Japanese investment. So that in spite of the nationalist antagonism sometimes that break out between China and Japan over things like Senkaku Islands and territory and culture and the war, there's an underneath level of tremendous cooperation in terms of economic growth and investments.
Well, is it going to be the case that to deal with this problem, and as you say, it's not just a problem in Japan, it's a problem elsewhere in the industrial world, that the Japanese are going to have to start thinking differently about how easy or how difficult it is for non-Japanese to come to Japan to live and work and raise families?
Yeah, that's been an ongoing issue for at least 20-some years. I mentioned earlier my kids were in elementary school in Japan, and the textbooks for social sciences were all about the internationalization of the society and how you need to welcome other kids and other people into society. I must say, my two boys were extremely welcomed into the school system at the elementary level. They made lots of room for them. They were not discriminated against. I think Japan has made tremendous steps in that way. If you go in Kyoto, for example, one of the major cities, you find Korean writing, Korean alphabet, Hangul, on the subway stations and throughout the city. Japan has become far more, in many ways, international, I think, than the United States, in some ways, in some measures, depending on how you look at it. But the question remains, and it remains for Europe, it remains, of course, for our country and for Japan, as to what they will do about labor needs in the future. I think it's also important to keep in mind that in the 70s and 80s, Japan addressed a similar problem through technology. The idea was that you could get more economic growth out of technology per worker. And I think that part of Japan's attempt to respond to the demographic question is going to be to look at technology again and see how much more wealth and growth they can extract out of high technology investments rather than simply increasing the number of laborers. That won't address the entire question, mm-hmm. and we're still left with the problem of immigrant laborers and an international culture and international society, which I'm happy to report the Japanese media and the government, the people, are addressing as best I think anyone can. Perhaps in many ways they're ahead of most of the American people in thinking about international questions, ethnicity, identity, and things like that.
We have a couple of minutes left. We have one more caller. We'll try to get in here, here locally, here in Champaign-Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Good show. The news mentioned a Westerner, one of the first to get a Nihonjia Japanese name and the ID card. What's involved in that, and what are the advantages, like owning property and so on? Thanks. Listen off air.
All right.
Right. Very good question. In fact, there have been a number of Westerners who have become Japanese. Back in the late 19th century, Lafcadio Hearn was one of the first. But under the current constitution, there's been a revision of the nationality law. I think it was in the early 1990s, which has removed many of the formal obstacles. So that, for example, you don't have to take a Japanese name anymore to be a Japanese citizen. Blood has nothing to do with it. There's a process that seeks to discern how serious you are about the citizenship. So there's a period of time. I think they expect you to have some facility with the Japanese language and general kinds of familiarity like that. But they've entirely removed the ethnic and racial barriers that were deemed to have prevented many people from becoming Japanese. The real question isn't Westerners. There are a handful of Westerners, including a rather notorious fellow up in Hokkaido who got involved in a public bath scandal and became Japanese so that he could continue taking public baths. The real question are Koreans and Chinese, and particularly Korean-Japanese, people who've never been to Korea, don't speak Korean, ethnic Koreans who have been prevented from having Japanese citizenship on the basis of ethnicity. The most recent revision of the nationality law now allows them, if they choose, to become Japanese citizens. But there remain cultural and other kinds of barriers on both the Japanese side and on many of the Korean people's side that prevent all of them from becoming Japanese citizens.
We are going to have to leave it at that because we've come to the end of the time. Professor Doak, we want to say thanks very much for giving us some of your time today. We certainly appreciate it.
Thank you, David. It's good talking with you again.
Our guest, Kevin Doak, he is a professor and also department chair of East Asian Languages and Cultures at Georgetown University, has been there since 2002. And before that, from 1994 until 2002, he was on faculty here at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. The programming today is made possible in part by a grant from the Living Yoga Center in downtown Champaign, offering a variety of classes designed to help students bring balance into their lives by finding strength and serenity through the practice of yoga. The winter schedule begins January 3rd. I guess that was yesterday. New introductory classes begin on January 18th. For more information, call 384-5829 or visit their website at www.livingyogacenter.net. Programming here on AM 580, also made possible by a grant from the Thrifty Nichols American Classifieds, distributed each Thursday in over 100 towns in East Central Illinois, on the web at AmericanClassifieds.com. Coming up a little bit later today, as part of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll do a little daydreaming about the coming of spring and summer. This conversation will be all about gardening. And two guests who have certainly been on the program before, Chuck Voigt and Diane Nolan from the University of Illinois. They can answer your questions about flowers, vegetables, herbs, and much more. That follows the 1 o'clock news. Later on, you'll hear about a girl who grew up a free black person in America when most of the country had slavery. Celeste Quinn will be talking with writer Tanya Bolden about Maricha Lyons. Celeste Quinn is the host for the program. Gets underway at noon here on AM 580 with the usual mix of news, weather, sports, and other things. That's the Afternoon Magazine. In the next hour of this program, we'll talk with Noah Feldman. He is Associate Professor of Law at New York University, has been an advisor to the transitional government in Iraq, and we'll be talking about the difficulties of nation building in Iraq today. He's written a book on this titled What We Owe Iraq, and he'll talk with us in the next hour of the show. We'll have news from National Public Radio 1 minute past the hour. First, though, an update in the market, so please stay tuned.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 85 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young